Lesson six has to do with God, comparisons, and I think this is very, very important. Comparing God in Islam and in folk Islam and formal Islam. We were just talking about him last lecture at the end, weren't we? In other words, talking about how much we need God and how much we desire him, not only for security, but for meaning and life and purpose. All of us struggle with that. You struggle with it all of your lives. We need God, and we need him very, very badly. But thinking of the relationship, in other words, relation to ideal beliefs, you know, Muslims in many ways are seeking God. I think of, we used to call some people in Pakistan, some Muslims, we called them, you know, not very many, truly, but some were sort of like Nicodemus. They were seem to be seeking God. But I think that Muslims, they have a desire for God. They worship him, if we can use that word in a loose term, unknowingly. In other words, they cannot know him within the system of Islam. So when we use the word worship, we're not using it any other way but to bow down to him or to acknowledge him. But just like, you know, Jesus used the term when he spoke to the Samaritan woman, he says, you worship what you don't know. And also Paul, remember in Acts 17, he said, you have an inscription here to the unknown God. So and he used the word worship. So I'm not using the word worship as if it's knowing God, but they are bowing down to him. And they want to think about him. In fact, they have many ways and means to constantly remind themselves of who, of God, that he exists, that he's there. Far more God-conscious than we are, in a sense. In other words, when I'm talking about the West, they put up signs all over the place and the buses and one thing another about God. But one thing they do, it is, I'm not saying that this is totally folk Islam, but the poor people in particular, and I wished I had a blackboard here to write on, but if you cup your hands, both of them, you will see an upside down V and a 1 in the left hand, and that's in Arabic stands for 81. And then in the next one, if you wrinkle up your hands, provided you have wrinkly hands, you in the next one you will see a 1 and then another, actually a V upside down is 8. So you have 81 and 18. And what does that mean? That's 99. So your hands, you see, can remind you of God. And I think it's a sign, really, of the fact that Muslims want to be thinking about God, and they want to mention him. Now, it's true that they mention him in ways that are wrong. In other words, like we talked about last lecture, putting his name up on the foundation or up on the house, mashallah, or they might say bismillah in the name of God to ward off evil spirits, as I mentioned before. A man having intercourse with his wife will say bismillah so that the baby doesn't become a devil. Or they might say inshallah if God wills. You know, there is truth in that. If God wills, we'll do this and that and the other thing. But what I'm trying to say is that folk Muslims use these terms for in different ways. And when we say folk Muslims, we're not talking about a minority. We're talking about most of the Muslims in the world. Now, we did mention the 99 names of God, and Muslims, by cupping their hands, can remind themselves of that. But one name of God, one of those 99 names of God, Al-Qahar, can be used magically to harm others. God's name can compel him to fulfill requests. In other words, see, the idea of manipulating God, forcing him to do some things, to fulfill requests. Zikr, which is, or dhikr, whichever you want to pronounce it, zikr is also somewhat magical. You're naming, you know, going over the 99 names of God, and there is some magical thing to it. Amulets through God's names are written. For instance, one of the names that women in particular like, one of those 99 names of God women like oftentimes, is Al-Halim, the patient one or the humble one. So, in other words, but that Al-Kahar is one that's used, in other words, perhaps to give harm. And I could have taken you to a scripture verse for that, but I'll do wait just a minute. But let's just think about another a couple of things here. Books and sources. A book by the name of Friedlander talks about the 99 names of God. It was written in Lagos, and the use there of in folk Islam or popular Islam is totally different than the Orthodox Muslims would want to use it. This is another book by Friedlander, The Whirling Dervishes, being an account of the Sufi order known as the Mevlis, and its founder, the poet and mystic Mevlana Jalaluddin Rumi. So that's a pretty long title. Muslims have their sources. Now, thinking too, while we're on the topic here of how the books are used, there is a difference between bibliolatry, which is worship of the book, and what does bibliomancy mean? Well, it means the same thing in Islam as it does in anything else, that Muslims will use this book, this Quran here, they will use this Quran to work powerful things on people, such as his names, or they'll use it to prevent magic and one thing another. So there are two words there, bibliolatry, which is worship of the book, and I think Muslims, for all practical purposes, do worship the book. Some of you, I think, would be aware that right at this moment, another case has come up in Pakistan where a little girl by the name of Rimsha Masih means Christian, in the north of actually near the capital of Islamabad in Pakistan, was accused of burning the Quran. What happened was that she is, as most Christians are, a lot of Christians in Pakistan, sweeper Christians. They do that for a profession. She was sweeping up. And somebody said that you swept up certain portions of a religious book that was used to teach religious instruction. And in that book were verses, you know, Quranic, some words from the Quran. And they accused this little illiterate girl. There was first some suggestion that she was mentally handicapped, which may be true and it might not be true. It doesn't make any difference. She was very, very young, perhaps 11, maybe 14, whatever. But definitely illiterate. She wouldn't have known. She can't read and write. Most of the people in Pakistan cannot read and write. Certainly those Christians up there, the sweepers, cannot. And so she was put in prison. It has since then been revealed that the imam himself set people up to it, may even have given false evidence. In any event, Christians in the area were terrified. They fled because homes had been burned, Christian homes. And you see, this illustrates that Muslims basically worship the book. Now, is that Orthodox Islam? I don't think so. I think it's folk Islam, because bibliolatry is not Orthodox Islam. But when people get so wound up. The imam you see in the mosque on a Friday says, "You guys, you're really not good Muslims," and he shamed them into action. And so they went out and burned down houses, and then the police came and arrested this poor little girl. I've blogged about it in my blog, www.warrenlarson.com, and I'm very upset about this, that even a little girl is not spared who is illiterate. So we realize that this is the way that Muslims treat the Quran. Now, I wanted to read from you actually a bit of the Quran here, showing that amulets are used with names. And one of the verses from the Quran is Surah 2, 250 and 51. In fact, we'll probably go back a bit to 249. Samuel Zwemer, in his book, The Influence of Animism on Islam, mentions this. And I will refer to this, but I want to mention a couple of other things too in here in this passage, because I can't resist it. It talks here in 249, verse 249 of chapter 2. It says, when Talut set forth with the armies, who is Talut? That's Saul. Allah will test you at the stream. If any drinks of its water, he goes not with my army. Only those who taste not of it go with thee. A mere sip out of the hand is excused. But they all drank of it except a few. What does this make you think of? Gideon. Yes. And this is just an example of the anachronisms. In other words, the chronological misfit in the Quran. This is, in other words, they're mixing things up here, bringing in, Goliath and then Gideon. Gideon is probably at least 100 years before Saul. But this is because the Quran, in other words, Muhammad himself didn't have good sources. He didn't, how does he know the chronological order of things? He gets a bit here and a bit there and a bit everywhere else. That's why, by the way, I don't think that this book here is so, I don't think that Muhammad was necessarily demon-possessed. That I don't accept. I think that he was confused. I think that he was confused, and that's why you have such a misappropriation of the facts in the Quran. Another example of this, of course, is Maryam, with the word for Mary in Arabic. Maryam in the Quran, the same who's the mother of Jesus, is mixed up with the story of Maryam, the sister of Aaron and Moses. So that's a little bit off the topic, but let's go on. This is the verse that is sometimes used for harm against another. 250, when they advanced to meet Goliath, you see it goes on to talk about Goliath and his forces, they prayed, "Our Lord, pour out constantly on us and make our steps firm." And then by Allah's will, they routed them, 251, and David slew Goliath. So you see, it's verses of power where David overcomes Goliath. So you can see that. Interestingly here, too, the commentary, 286, note that how the whole story is compressed into a few words as regards narration, but its spiritual lessons are dwelt upon by many points of view. Here he says this, Yusuf Ali, "The Old Testament is mainly interested in the narrative, which is full of detail, but says little about the universal truths of which every story is a parable. The Quran assumes the story, but tells the parable." Now, this is a pretty weak explanation for mixing up facts and really all of that, but nevertheless, that's what he says. So you see amulets being used with from the Quran, and then here is a magic square that is used to prevent harm. I've never actually seen this myself, but read about it being used in the Arabic world, Arabic speaking world, where all of these numbers anywhere you go add up to 65. you know, kitty corner or up and down or whatever way you go adds up to 65. And this square is used to prevent harm. Quite an interesting square, isn't it? That is used. It's used in parts of the Muslim world. I don't know whether you've experienced it or not, but it's not used universally in the Muslim world, but is used sometimes. Now, another thing to mention here is the use of the rosary. It is used for prayer and zikr, in other words, zikr, the mentioning of God's names over and over again. And it's good to mention his names, but to mention his names to ward off evil is not a good thing. I could mention here, too, it's also used for divination, where a practitioner, somebody who's an authority, would choose one of those little things there for at random. In other words, a little red thing there by random, and then count towards the pointer, and that's one way that Muslims might be able to divine whether something is true or false, who put the curse on you. So the rosary is used for prayer, for zikr, in other words, God's name, but it's also used for divination and for healing. Samuel Zwemer says it's used for healing. And I could say just a little bit more about how the rosary is used. It's called I forget what it's used in Pakistan. I forget the word. But anyway, oftentimes the holy man or the practitioner would read the Fatiha, which is the first surah, the first part of the Quran, and he would breathe on it, and he would pick a bead and count towards the pointer. And he might, you know, if somebody says, well, did so-and-so put a curse on me? So he reads the Fatiha, or she reads the Fatiha, and then counts towards the pointer. Yes, no, yes, no, and keeps heading towards the pointer. And if you end on yes, when you're saying yes, that's the word. If you end on no, then it's no. But you might end on maybe. So I don't know exactly how that's done, but let's just keep in mind that the rosary is used for those purposes. Now, here's another thing, and we end with this, that the midwife would use an egg. And you may not be able to see this clearly, but a midwife, especially in village areas, would take an egg, and she would wrap the egg in a little cloth, and then she would begin to twist the ends to find out if it's a boy or a girl. And so she says, boy, girl, boy, girl, boy, girl, and keeps tightening it and tightening it and tightening it. And if it breaks when she says boy, then it is a boy. If not, it's a girl. I don't know how accurate this is. Nowadays, I suppose, with ultrasound in many Muslim areas, it's not used. But let's keep in mind that these are some of the ways. There are folk practices that are used in Muslim areas, but not just Muslim areas, other areas as well.